From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan's legislature continues to meet in person, up close, and unmasked.
The legislature is quite literally the last institution and workplace where they could be working remotely, like the rest of the white-collar workforce of Michigan, but they're not.
Also, former Detroit Mayor Dave Bing talks about hard landings from the NBA to the business world to the arena of Detroit politics.
You go into politics, you're lucky if 51% of the people supports you. So all the goodwill that I had achieved and built up over my years in Detroit was at risk.
And Michigan limps toward the end of a truly messed up season with a cancellation of the Ohio State game.
It's a huge thing for the coaches, for the players, for the Big Ten Conference. This is the Big Ten's marquee rivalry.
All that coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later today on the show, we talk with former Detroit Mayor Dave Bing about his NBA years, his business career, and his time at the city in the midst of what we thought was the biggest crisis Detroit had ever faced.
I made the decision without any political background, so I had to really learn quick, and a lot of it was on the job, which made it that much more difficult.
That's coming up later in the program. But first, Rudy Giuliani brought the circus to Lansing last week and left with a COVID-19 diagnosis just a couple of days later. It's not clear if President Trump's attorney got COVID before he was in Michigan or contracted the virus while he was here. The result has been the Michigan State House canceling session as several members were exposed to Giuliani. Here to talk about the outbreak at the Capitol is Chad Livengood, senior editor with Crane's Detroit Business. Chad, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
Legislative leaders have been reticent to give COVID positive numbers among their lawmakers, but we did get a few more details. What more do we know about how much COVID is spreading among our elected officials because of meetings at the state capitol?
So yesterday, after some pressure from reporters, the House disclosed that there have been 8 representatives to date who have tested positive for COVID-19 and 21 staff members. Now, that is cumulative over a 9-month period, and that does not include Representative Isaac Robinson, the late Representative Isaac Robinson, who passed away in late March of a suspected case of COVID-19 after he went to the hospital and just died 5 hours later. So we don't know the current extent of COVID-19 within the ranks of the legislature and the staff. But Mayor Giuliani's appearance last week at the House Oversight Committee, where he lodged all these really baseless conspiracies about the election, and then testing, and then him ending up in a hospital 4 days later, really kind of put a really fine point on this. The legislature in general has very, very lax controls on COVID-19 as an institution and as an employer. They do require their employees, the staff members, there's 300 or 400 of them between both chambers, to wear masks during the day and to follow a lot of the COVID safety protocols the rest of us have to do in workplaces. But they're not requiring the 148 members who are elected under a kind of stretch of an argument where they say, look, we can't require anything of any individual member. We can't interfere in their ability to vote, essentially. And so we can't just require them to wear a mask as a condition to get on the floor of the House in order to hit the green or red button at their desk. And so they have, particularly in the House, been very lax about this. And you've seen this on the floor where there are half the Republican caucus is without masks. The entire Democratic caucus is masked up. And then in committee, in the Giuliani committee hearing last week, there were 5 Republican House members who didn't wear masks for most of the entire committee. Giuliani didn't wear a mask. President Trump's campaign attorney, Jenna Ellis, she did not wear a mask. She has since tested positive as well for COVID-19. And there was one Democratic representative, Cynthia Johnson of Detroit, who also was without a mask. And so as a result of that, you had the Ingham County Health Department director kind of come out and try to order those members to quarantine, which was kind of, she eventually sort of backed away from that because of this sort of separation of powers.
Chad, do you know if that stuck? Did any members follow quarantine orders?
We're not sure if they are or not, but you know, House Speaker Lee Chatfield came out and said you can't order individual members of the legislature to quarantine, and he pushed back on that. So sort of separate of the Giuliani exposure that caused Tuesday's session to be canceled, a top House Republican staffer tested positive for COVID on Tuesday. And because this staffer had been in contact with multiple reps separate from the oversight committee, they canceled a session for the rest of this week. And I wrote a piece about how this is really essentially paralyzing the legislature, that every time there is a COVID outbreak, they got to shut down session. And here we are in the lame duck session. There's 6 days remaining to do the business of the people, to consider major issues like extending unemployment insurance, giving aid to small businesses, a whole host of criminal justice reforms that if they don't pass, they will die. The bills, and they have to, you know, have to start over in January. And the legislature is quite literally the last institution and workplace where they could be working remotely, like the rest of the white collar workforce of Michigan, but they're not.
I'm still trying to get my head around this. There was a workplace complaint filed against House leadership for holding crowded committee hearings in person and not requiring masks. Again, this is a state OSHA complaint filed against state elected officials. Can you tell us more about the complaint?
Yes, a staff member in the legislature anonymously complained that this is a hazard on the workplace. Just like if you were exposing people to other types of hazards in a workplace, this person contends that they're in danger at the workplace with these maskless members and audience members. There were numerous audience members at the Giuliani hearing without masks, and you don't know, you know, if they've got COVID or not. There's no real basic health screenings, and even if there is, you know, asymptomatic carriers or the way this virus continues to ravage through our society. And so so this is a real interesting standoff. I'm not sure how far it's going to go, to be honest, but you have an arm of the Whitmer administration that is investigating the legislature, separate branch of government, to see if they are in compliance of the Whitmer administration's rules on COVID. And the legislature has to date not done anything to pass its own rules on COVID in the workplace. They haven't passed a single major bill or sent one to the governor's office quite yet in 9 months. And now the governor is using existing power that is being enforced on other employers, you know, whether it's white collar or blue collar jobs, to ensure that that employers you know, mitigate risks to spreading the virus, and by doing all these basic simple things like social distancing and mask wearing on the job.
Is there any reason to think that Speaker Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Shirky are going to change course on any of this? I mean, this is now about as full blown a public health emergency as we've seen so far.
They have not shown any change, of course, to date. And they only have canceled session, I should probably note this, when Republicans get sick. Senate Minority Leader Jim Mananick contracted COVID in early November, and they didn't cancel Senate session for the days after the election. He was just absent. I mean, he got an excused absence. But there's someone in the top leadership of the legislature who they didn't even cancel session for him. But this has happened before, back in August when Senator Tom Barrett of Eaton County got COVID. They canceled session for a week and a half and ended up having to hold a session day on a Saturday in order to get critical legislation passed that the schools of Michigan needed in order to reopen at the end of August. And And that just that one shutdown is kind of a good example of how that delayed decision making among 500 school districts on their reopening plans because the legislature couldn't be in session. And just another example, the Senate is expected to pass maybe as soon as today a bill that would that seeks to rein in the governor's health department's epidemic orders that are now the law of the land for these closures and mask mandates by basically requiring them to get renewal from the legislature for 28 days. And the governor is likely to veto this bill. The irony here is that if they did get this on the books, and then they had another one of these shutdowns where they couldn't operate, they couldn't actually come in and authorize the 28-day extension because the legislature still has not adopted any kind of means or platform for voting remotely.
All of this is making my head spin. Chad, I just have one more question, and it's about the lawsuit that the state of Texas filed against Michigan, along with Georgia and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, all four states, to overturn our election results. It looks like the Trump campaign has submitted this to the Supreme Court for consideration, although it's not clear whether or not the high court will take it up. Have you heard anything more about this?
Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky put out some tweets yesterday, sort of strongly encouraging this lawsuit to go forward. This is unlike anything I've ever seen, where you have another attorney general in another state trying to overturn the election results of another election. That's totally unfathomable. But this is 2020, and I guess all bets are off at this point.
That was Chad Livengood, senior editor with Crain's Detroit Business. Up next, what is the future of Michigan football after this truly unusual season amid COVID and the cancellation of the game with Ohio State?
Canceling that game, it certainly was an understandable decision given what Michigan was experiencing with its COVID-19 outbreak, but no small thing for sure to cancel a Michigan-Ohio State football game.
More after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's hard to imagine a more mixed bag of feelings than those of Michigan football fans this week. While everyone is feeling the pain of the truncated football season, from Spartan fans to Eagles fans and all of Michigan's other teams, who else had to cancel a 100-year-old rivalry game? The cancellation of Michigan's annual grudge match against Ohio State comes against the backdrop of leadership uncertainty and a head coach who's being actively courted within the NFL. Austin Meek is a staff writer for The Athletic, covering Michigan football. Austin, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So what kind of blowback is Michigan's athletic department dealing with for calling off the game this weekend?
Well, certainly it was a historic day when you think about the history of the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry that had been played every year since 1918. In fact, it's kind of ironic that streak began
during a pandemic, right?
When college football was attempting to play during a pandemic. Yeah, and games were being canceled. Michigan only played 5 games that year and ended up sharing the national championship. And this year it's Ohio State that is 5-0 and trying to win a national championship. And playing that Michigan game would have been significant for the Buckeyes. So canceling that game, it certainly was an understandable decision given what Michigan was experiencing with its COVID-19 outbreak. But no small thing for sure to cancel a Michigan-Ohio State football game.
The rivalry is, needless to say, hotly anticipated by fans. But, I mean, this game is a huge deal for players also. Did you talk to any players, maybe especially seniors, about how they're feeling right now?
We haven't been able to speak to any players on the team. Initially, they had scheduled an opportunity for that, but then due to the COVID-19 outbreak, that ended up being canceled. But yeah, it's a huge thing for the coaches, for the players, for the Big Ten Conference. This is the Big Ten's marquee rivalry. It generates a huge amount of TV revenue for the league. And there's a lot of pride wrapped up on both sides. And I know from the perspective of Michigan people, it had been suggested that Michigan might essentially try to duck Ohio State and cancel this game, either because they were afraid of getting blown out or because they wanted to damage Ohio State's season. And that provoked quite a strong response from people at Michigan, including athletic director Ward Manuel, who was adamant that if there was any way that Michigan could have played this game, that they would have.
I saw that video he made. He was spitting fire for sure. The Big Ten rules, what people mean about spoiling the game is that Big Ten rules say you have to play six games in order to be eligible for the Big Ten championship. But I've seen some reporting that those rules may be eliminated so Ohio State can play in the title game. Rules? What rules? There's a pandemic going on here, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we're all making it up on the fly this season. And when the Big Ten decided to come back and play this year after initially saying that they weren't going to play in the fall, they did make a rule that said in order to be eligible for the conference championship game, teams had to play at least six games. And that became complicated at the end of the season when the Michigan-Ohio State game was canceled, leaving Ohio State, which is clearly the Big Ten's best team, with only five games. So the Big Ten athletic directors spoke this week and voted to lift that six-game minimum so Ohio State could play in the championship game, which is probably the right decision if the goal is to reward the best team, but certainly came with some controversy because that had been the rule that they put in place before the season.
Yeah. Austin, this has been a season in which the NCAA, the Big Ten, and the schools have really tied themselves in knots, trying to get some normalcy of play and some normalcy of a season. And now here we are. Everything has been so on again, off again, and just wrought with controversy. Not to mention the fact that this was a season when our national conversation about college athletes and the lack of compensation for them was really just getting interesting. Do you see any changes coming out of what's happened here this season? Or is everybody just really hoping this is going to go away as soon as possible and we can resume the kind of football that we're accustomed to?
I think there is a very strong sense of wanting to get back to normal in all ways of life. And certainly sports is part of what we think of as normal life. And I think there was a hope that we would be able to have a college football season this year to give a little sense of that normalcy in the middle of what's been a really difficult time for our country. Unfortunately, I think what we've seen with the football season is the same thing we've seen everywhere, which is it's just impossible to have normal right now. And with the number of games that have been canceled, the number of schools that have had outbreaks, we're reminded every day that playing football in the middle of a pandemic is a really difficult thing to do. And I do think that this season has really opened people's eyes to the sacrifices that the players make. And they're not paid. They're amateurs. They're not professionals. And they have been asked to make a lot of sacrifices to make this season happen. And I do think that one thing that could come from this season, and we'll see where it goes, but I think more people, more football fans, have an awareness of just what the players put into it in order to keep college football going. And of course, college football makes a lot of money for a lot of people, but not for the players.
Let's talk about Jim Harbaugh. A number of sources said earlier this week that Ward Manuel was trying very hard to make a path for Jim Harbaugh to stay at Michigan as head coach, maybe with less salary and an adjusted coaching staff. What are you hearing right now about the negotiations?
Yeah, I believe that that's accurate, that there is a pathway for Jim Harbaugh to return to Michigan, even though his tenure up to this point has not lived up to the great expectations that existed when he was hired. And certainly this season has been a challenge for Michigan at 2-4. But Jim Harbaugh is beloved here still as a former player, a star quarterback for Bo Schembechler. It was such a momentous occasion when Jim Harbaugh was hired. And I think there's still hope that they can make this work, although it does feel like they're kind of down to the last chance here. And it's not a given that he will be back. There's certainly speculation that he might consider a return to the NFL, where he had success before he came to Michigan. So it's a tenuous situation right now as they try to figure out what the future is.
From what you know of Jim Harbaugh, what's in it for him to stay another year? What's in it for him to extend his contract?
Yeah, I think that Jim Harbaugh does have an emotional attachment to this place that he wouldn't have to any other job. This is home for him. And I really believe that this was the place that he wanted to retire. And the track record with Jim Harbaugh is that he doesn't tend to stay anywhere very long. He's had other coaching jobs where after about 4 years, everybody was ready to move on from it. But I do feel like it's hard to quantify, but there is sort of an intangible value in being at the place that you call home. And I think for that reason, Jim Harbaugh would be motivated to try really hard to make this work and to give it another shot, even if the odds were stacked against him. But at the same time, everybody understands the business of coaching, that if you're not winning games, you're probably not going to stay very long in the job that you have. And sometimes the best move is to get a fresh start somewhere else.
Remember that Jim Harbaugh was one of the voices behind the push to let Big Ten football go forward this season. And when the Big Ten did reverse its decision and put testing and safety procedures in place, there was great rejoicing. But now players are still getting sick and the game with Ohio State has been canceled. Do you think that people are feeling like it was worth it to try to make the sacrifices that were made?
You know, Jim Harbaugh was asked that question recently, and he said that he felt like it was worthwhile to try to play this season, even with all the challenges that have come along with it. Although I have to believe that if coaches and players had known back in August and September how this season would have played out, at least they would have had to think twice about it. Coaches are wired in a certain way not to back down from anything. And we know Jim Harbaugh especially is ultra competitive, not going to shy away from a challenge. But this is such a different challenge than anything that coaches and players are used to dealing with. There was a lot of confidence and probably false confidence, frankly, that schools and teams would be able to navigate this pandemic. But as we've seen, no amount of preparation, no amount of protocols can ensure that you're going to be able to play safely. And I think the outbreaks that we've seen in the Big Ten, at least it has to raise the question of, was this the right thing to do, or should the Big Ten have stuck with its original decision and not tried to play football this fall?
Austin Meek is a staff writer for The Athletic covering Michigan football. Austin, take care. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, April.
Here's a little Michigan trivia for you. Do you know the state tree? If you answered the white pine, also known as the eastern white pine, you are correct. But here at Stateside, we wanted to know the how and the why Michigan ended up with this choice. To fill us in, we're joined by the Michigan History Center's Northern Lower Peninsula historian, Hillary Pine. No relation. Hi, Hillary. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So let's get to it. Of all the amazing trees in Michigan, why did the white pine stand out?
Well, it really comes down to the logging era that was so big in Michigan during the late 1800s. And lumberjacks, they kind of came from the eastern United States. Logging was big there when the country was first colonized. And, really quickly the trees get cut down. They make their way to Michigan, and we have these wonderful stands of old growth white pine.
What made the white pine such a good tree from a lumber industry perspective?
It is really lightweight, but also very strong. So it makes a wonderful building material. And also, lumberjacks call white pine cork pine because it floats. So it's really easy to transport it via rivers or other waterways.
So you can sort of envision what we all tend to think of when we think of lumberjacks, you know, throwing the logs in the river down to the mill.
Exactly.
Right. And was it found all across Michigan at that time?
No. So if you imagine, you know, like we all do, those of us from Michigan, we like to hold up our hands to show where we're from. If you hold up your palm as if it's the Lower Peninsula and kind of imagine this line that runs from kind of the bottom knuckle of your thumb, so sort of that Bay City, Saginaw area, and down and across to kind of the the left lower area of the inside of your palm. So kind of the Muskegon area. So this imaginary line running across the state. So everything north of that tends to be a lot of sandy, acidic soil. And that is where white pine likes to grow. So the logging industry in the late 1800s was really happening in the northern lower peninsula, some in the mid portion of the lower peninsula, and up in the upper peninsula as well.
Not only did you just give us a very visual way to figure that out, but that's the first time I've ever heard somebody do that in the course of a scholarly interview. So thank you. As a tree, when we're standing in the forest, do you think the white pine is easy to recognize for those of us who are novices at tree identification?
For me personally, you know, my background's in history, not forestry. So I'm getting better at my tree identification, but I find it much easier to identify a white pine actually when it's younger and the branches are lower to the ground. It's kind of a good way to tell the difference kind of between a red pine or a white pine is grab one of the bundles of needles. And in the word white, there are five letters. And in a bundle of white pine needles, there are typically five needles versus a red pine, three letters in the word red. And there's usually three needles in a red pine bundle.
That is quite the design feature. So putting on the historian hat again, how did the white pine become the official state tree back in the 1950s?
Yeah, so there were the school kids in Saginaw's Weber Junior High School, and they must have been learning about the importance of Michigan's logging era and how important it was to growing our state and our economy and our population. And their teacher encouraged them to contact their local state representative. So they did. And that was a man by the name of Holly E. Hubble. He was the representative for the Saginaw area. And he introduced this bill to create the white pine as our state tree. And that all happened in 1955. So on October 14th, 1955, the act was officially put into law, and it was Public Act 7 of that year.
So it sounds like this was as much a nod to industry and business as it was to the ecological history of the white pine.
Oh, yes. We here in Michigan, we were the national leaders in lumber production from about 1870 to 1900. And that brought $4 billion into Michigan's economy. And that was money then, not adjusted for inflation. So you can see that for the time, that's a just significant amount of money. And people were immigrating from all over the world to Michigan because there were so many jobs, both in logging camps and in mills. And the effect that this industry had on our economy, our population, can still be felt today in many places.
How common is the white pine around us today in Michigan's forests?
Today, of course, this a lot was cut down, but we've done a lot of reforestation. So it's pretty common today. Unfortunately, that old growth white pine that the lumberjacks treasured, not too much of that. But if you come to a place like where I work at Hartwick Pine State Park, we do have a beautiful stand of old growth white pine. It's the largest in the lower peninsula. But all this reforestation that's happened in the past several decades, a lot of white pine has been replanted. So you can still find it. It's quite abundant.
Do you have a favorite place to see it?
It would have to be Hartwick Pines.
Right. Could you describe the scenery there for those who've never been?
Yeah. So if you've never been or you've never wandered through an old growth forest, it's quite a bit different than a lot of our other Michigan forests, which typically tend to be quite dense. But in old growth forest, there's lots of space on the forest floor. And of course, the trees are really tall. Ours at Hartwick Pines are up to 160, 165 feet tall. And as you walk the trail, you're literally, you know, encased in this canopy of old growth trees towering above you. You can see quite a distance into the forest because there's not much growing on the forest floor. And in the winter, especially, it makes for just a beautiful sight. You go snowshoeing into the woods and you can get up close with those old growth trees. the snow-covered boughs hanging above you. I can see deer beds. It's really an incredible experience.
Hillary, are there ways in which the White Pine's economic history is still with us today?
So I mentioned earlier, there are ways in which we can still see the effects of Michigan logging era today. And one of those ways are all the stumps that are left behind. So White Pine, they rot from the inside out. So you end up with these almost skeletal looking tree stumps with the outside, the bark still there. And if you're wandering in northern Michigan or the Upper Peninsula, and you come across these really large hollowed out stumps, there's a good chance what you're looking at is this kind of this specter of the logging era.
Hillary Pine is the Michigan History Center's Northern Lower Peninsula historian. Hillary, thank you so much for talking with us about the White Pine.
Oh, you're very welcome.
In a moment, we'll speak with the former mayor of Detroit, Dave Bing, about his new memoir and Detroit's challenges, past and present. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Dave Bing has packed about four or five lifetimes into 77 years. A true NBA all-star who played point guard for the Pistons back in the days when Aretha and Smokey made for a glamorous halftime scene at Cobo Arena. He was friends with Muhammad Ali and Marvin Gaye and knew enough Michigan business leaders to pivot out of basketball into a successful second career in manufacturing. Years later, as the city of Detroit was foundering on the edge of the Great Recession, Bing successfully ran to become Detroit's mayor. It was a time when the city, rocked by Kwame Kilpatrick's scandal-ridden tenure, needed stability, and Dave Bing stayed at the helm through Detroit's bankruptcy. All these jaw-dropping events are covered in his new autobiography called Attacking the Rim. Dave Bing, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you so very much. My pleasure to be with you.
In the book, you write about how when you first came to Detroit, you know, you were this first-round draft pick making a good salary, one of the stars of the team already. There was a lot of anticipation. But you came to Detroit, and you went down with one of the front office guys to the First National Bank of Detroit and got turned down flat for a mortgage loan. It's an amazing anecdote about the times, and so unthinkable by today's standards. And later on, one of the bank's executives came to you and apologized and offered to bring you into the bank with an entry-level job during the summertime. There are so many astonishing things about this story, but I wanted to ask you why you decided to go in, take the offer, and go to work at a place that had turned you down as a client.
You know, I'm one, I never hold things against people. You know, that was a corporate decision. And I understood, you know, big business had to make decisions, and they were not willing to take a risk. And they looked at me as a young guy just out of college with a family, wasn't from here, playing for, you know, one of the worst teams in the NBA, because the only reason I was drafted by the Pistons was because the Pistons and the Knicks were the worst two teams in the NBA. So the bank wanted to be safe. And, you know, I couldn't hold that against them. So as the season progressed, and I had a lot of success my rookie year.
So when Aubrey Lee, who was the vice president of NBD, called me to apologize, number one, and said they'd like to make amends for the decision that they made, and they would like to offer me a job by putting me into a training program. And I thought that was a good opportunity for me, because the decision wasn't about an individual. It was a corporate decision. And I accepted that as such, you know, trying to hold a grudge because you thought somebody may have done you wrong. It's just not part of my makeup. So I accepted his apology and also accepted the job. And I did that for 7 years, seven off seasons.
You have so many amazing stories in this book about your time with the Pistons and later in Washington during your NBA career. And I confess, I was behind on the lore. I didn't realize how many problems you were having with your eyesight all those years you were playing. And it was just astonishing to read about all this and realized at one point you were dealing with a detached retina. I mean, I think a lot of people just would not have known while you were playing that your eyesight was such a health problem for you. How did you manage during games?
You know, I guess basketball, like a lot of things, is all about repetition. Repetition and feel. And, you know, I knew how big the court was. I knew how high the basket was. I knew how far away from the basket the free throw line was. And so, you know, I just learned to make adjustments kind of on the fly. I never gave a second thought that because of my eyesight being what it was, that I would not be able to play. I mean, the fear was not with me at all until I had the detached retina in my good eye. That's when I was afraid, because all of a sudden I had learned to live my life, you know, with one eye. But when the good eye got hurt in an exhibition game is when I really started to worry about whether or not I'd be able to play again and whether or not I'd be able to see again. And so I was very fortunate that I had a great team of doctors who performed the operation. And the oldest doctor on that team basically said, you know, you probably shouldn't play again. I'm only 26 years old at the time, and I'm at the top of my game. And to hear the senior doctor say, you know, it's a big risk. And if you get hurt again, if that eye gets hurt again, you might not be able to see. So that was fear. And I knew the risk that was attached to that. But I never gave a second thought that if I could see, I'm going to play. And that's it. And I played another 8 years with that detached retina. The operation was successful.
You had already had this very full and very successful NBA career and reinvented yourself as the CEO in the steel industry when you decided to run for mayor. The city was in this moment when Kwame Kilpatrick's tenure was just falling apart. You had done so many things in your life already, but how did you know that you were ready to get into this very rough and tumble free-for-all that is Detroit city politics and city government?
The reality is I knew I wasn't ready. And so I therefore had to make a very, very hard decision. I knew what a precarious situation the city was in. I knew the things that Kwame had done because I had been very supportive of him. And as these things started to unravel, it was obvious to me that we needed more leadership in city government. And I never gave myself early on the thought that I was the one that would become the next mayor. So there was a lot of discussion I was having with a core group of friends and business associates who over time convinced me that I was the right guy at the right time to do this. I had built up a really good relationship with a lot of people in the city, in this area, you know, prior to thinking about politics. And the big risk for me was with all of the support that I had over time, you go into politics, which is a tough, different kind of business that you're lucky if 51% of the people support you. So all the goodwill that I had achieved and built up over my years in Detroit was at risk. But I said, you know, it's worth taking this risk because the city is bigger than me. The need for the city and its residents are bigger than me. So I made the decision without any political background, without a lot of knowledge in terms of government. So I had to really learn quick. And a lot of it was on the job, which made it that much more difficult.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Detroit mayor and NBA All-Star great Dave Bing. He has a new memoir called Attacking the Rim, My Journey from NBA Legend to Business Leader to Big City Mayor to Mentor. You write in the book about the many, many difficult moments that you had to face as mayor, culminating with the city's bankruptcy and the entree of Kevin Orr as the city's emergency manager. It was a very catalytic and hard time in Detroit. I wonder if the experiences that you got during that time, knowing what you now know about the city, and I guess how the state of Michigan works too, has this changed how you think about what it takes to move the needle on some of the really big issues? I'm thinking about stuff like the water shutoffs and foreclosure problems that Detroit has dealt with in recent years under Mayor Duggan, or maybe just about the city's chronic revenue problem, which has continued even after the bankruptcy.
A lot of the things that I had to deal with are still being confronted by Mayor Duggan and his administration. When you are in that much debt, and I think Kevin Orr and his team did a very credible job because we were $18 billion in debt and long-term liabilities. The pension and health care was killing the city. You know, we had 54 unions that you had to deal with, and all of them were trying to protect their people, their employees. And even though I think Kevin did an outstanding job by eliminating about $7 billion of debt off the balance sheet, you know, the city is still left with $11 billion of debt and long-term liability to go forward. And because the tax revenue in the city is so important to generate the money that you need to run this city, you still have a lot of people who are either unemployed or underemployed and don't add a lot to the tax base, but yet depend on all of those city services. So I think Mayor Duggan and his administration came in. They had a much better balance sheet than I had to deal with, but they still got some problems going forward because, you know, we're not a destination city where you got a lot of people who want to move into the city. I mean, you have a city that had 1.5 million people at one time, and now you're roughly around 700,000 people. So you've lost over half of your population. And most of those people that left were your middle class people where you were getting tax revenues from. So I think we still got some major problems that we've got to deal with. They just don't go away easy.
It's so crazy to me that you were such a success in the NBA, such a success in your business career. Bing Holdings did well. And yet, when you came to City Hall, you were the guy that people looked to after the Kilpatrick administration to bring back some order. What was it like being seen as that person who needed to play cleanup?
Well, it was a major challenge, no doubt in my mind about it. But, you know, the thing that was rewarding to me is before I went into City Hall, I, like so many other people, thought that a lot of city employees were only there for a paycheck. And when I came in and got to meet, especially city department directors, and then some people on down in the organization, it became very apparent that people were there because they loved the city and they wanted to see the city rebound. It made me feel emboldened that what I was doing was very dependent upon the people in the administration, the leadership. I was very fortunate that we didn't lose any of our top leaders, department heads. They stayed with me because they saw me as a guy who was trying to do the right thing, not trying to come in and make money. And a guy that would come to work every day and get down in the trenches with them and tell them the truth, let them know exactly where we were and the things that I thought we had to do. So there were no easy decisions. I mean, almost every major decision that I had to make was a negative impact on a lot of people here in the city. And so it was easy for people to turn against you. But we had to do what we had to do. I understood it. They understood it. And we stayed in the trenches and made it happen. And I think as we finished my term, I think we left the city in a much better position than we found it and made it much more possible for the Duggan administration to hit the ground running.
I got the sense reading the book that you really haven't had a lot of time to be able to enjoy Detroit. I mean, when you first came to town, it's true, you were part of the Pistons and very much a known figure, but, you know, you had a young family. You had a lot going on, obviously, during the years when you went into business. And when you were involved in politics, it was just nonstop. Have you been able to enjoy the city much in the past couple of years?
What I do enjoy about the city are its people. I've established an unbelievable amount of friendships that dates all the way back to when I first came into the city. And outside of family, those friendships mean a lot to me. So I had a lot of my friends that were worried about me and thought I was going nuts when I said, yeah, I'll run for mayor. But they stuck with me and they're with me today. And that's what I value. I've not had a lot of time to enjoy the city because you're always going from crisis to crisis. So there's a lot of work to be done. But when you step away from it for a moment and say, did I make a difference? Did we make a difference? The answer is absolutely yes, because I think if I had not made the decision to go into that position, we probably would have gone into bankruptcy quicker. A lot of people would have gotten hurt even worse than they did. And so I've never worried about trying to have a good time. The good time for me is to see people other than myself. I've been blessed. But to see other people lesser than me have a chance for a good life. And that's what I focus on, even today with the program that I started with young boys.
This mentoring program that you do write about in the book, what are you telling these young men about what they see around them right now? Massive, massive casualties due to COVID, a huge economic crisis, worse even than the one that you had to face down as mayor. What are you saying to them about this moment?
We are doing some things now with these young boys that I think will change their lives. So many people, because you're young, because you're Black, because you're poor, because you, in some cases, have an urban education, all of those things are deemed to be a negative for these boys. And so they never have somebody in their lives that are telling them, in spite of all of those negatives, you still can be a success. And the success comes from making sure there are role models, male role models in these boys' lives. So as I talk to them, I let them know what I went through personally. And, you know, they may not have the same opportunities that I have because of my athletic ability and then the good education that I got from public schools. But trying to really be a positive impact on the way they think and the way they see things is very, very important. You want them to understand that their dreams can come true and become a reality. But we tell them how to prepare for both the negatives and the positives and really focus on the positives, because there are just too many negatives that it's easy to say, I quit, I can't do this. And we want to make sure that we don't let them quit. When I look back at the boys who came in our program initially as ninth graders, now as seventh graders, we have a much longer tenure with them. And so our mentors have done a unbelievably significant job because they have stayed with these boys, in some cases from the ninth grade through graduation. And we have 100% graduation rate for all of our boys that have entered our program, which is kind of unbelievable.
Dave Bing's new book is Attacking the Rim, My Journey from NBA Legend to Business Leader to Big City Mayor to Mentor. Mayor, it's great to hear your voice. Stay safe, and thank you for talking to us.
Well, thank you so very much, and you all stay safe also.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for being with us. See you next time.